Out of the dark of the deep range and into the light of the deep strange. Come at the hour, come at the mothership. That is, Coast to Coast AM. Good evening to you. It's Sunday night, the second Sunday of the month, and here we are. Second half of the Zombie Jombie weekend. Tonight on the program, Meat-onomics. Meat-onomics? Yeah. Let me put it another way. How about a fascinating and terrifying descent into economic, social, political, environmental, and ethical insanity? Yep. Book is Meat-onomics, How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much. And while we get ready for David Robinson Simon, author of said book, check out the site, meatonomics.com. Just like it sounds, meatonomics.com. He's a first-time guest, and we're experiencing some telephone issues. Wasn't it great talking with Dr. Miller last night? Wasn't that cool? But how about that phone? Whatever happened to Western Electric? You know, a phone as heavy as a boat anchor, made to last a person's lifetime. But no, that monopoly had to be destroyed. So our reward for fairness is mediocrity, and those who build crummy products, well, they get money. Nice. All right, anyway, David Simon will join us for the first hour, and then, and I mentioned he's here for the first time, which is totally cool with me. Our second guest for the bulk of the program, David Brin. He has not been on this program for 14 years and 3 days. Last appearing January 9, 2002, hosted by Bell. Whatever happened to, what was his name? J.C. Webster. He's always going, Bell. Well, anyway, his books are Existence, The Transparent Society, that's another one, Star Wars on Trial, and The Postman. And he's davidbrin.com, D-A-V-I-D-B-R-I-N, and also davidbrin.blogspot.com. Anyway, just a quick apology to those who called last night, and we did not get to answer your call. I mean, we put you on hold, but you call, we answer. We didn't get to answer, so we'll catch you on the next one. With David Brin tonight, we're going to talk about what if the 21st century actually begins in 2014. There's a lot of stuff going along, but we've only got an hour. We only have an hour with David Robinson Simon, so I'm going to be very, very brief here. This is one that really grabbed me. And actually, it's funny, it just hit the Drudge Report last night. I didn't mention it last night, but I did mention it to you a couple of 3 weeks ago, and that is, take that toilet seat away from your ear. Yes. Cell phone is 18 times nastier than a public toilet. You believe this? Well, look at the screen. It's disgusting. So basically, yes, mobile phones are 18 times dirtier than public bathrooms. Now, there's a device out there that says it's an ultraviolet radiation device, kills the bacteria's DNA so they can't live on your phone anymore. But the smartphone you see is always warm. It's stored in dark places, so bacteria grow on your phone. And that's a statement by Dan Barnes, co-founder of Phone Soap, which was displaying its device, which sanitizes the phone and recharges it at the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas. So anyway, there you go. Take that thing away from your face. Sort of like don't touch that dial. You don't know where it's been. All right. No further digression. I'll toss in a few little news items as they are appropriate to toss in as we go through the night. But let's get ready for David Robinson Simon. Meat-onomics. What's this all about?
I love chicken fried steak.
Yeah, I know it. But you're eating too much of it. There's a commercial on recently about a razor. It just looks like an old safety razor. It appears to be well-made. And I think it's one of the pawn shop star guys just saying, you just need this razor. Why do all these razor companies put out all of these multiple blade razors? He says, well, that's real simple. To get you to buy more blades. You pick up a pack of these things, and like this shaving paddle. It's enough to take your whole face off. And there are like five blades on it. And you want to buy replacement blades, and you can get a pretty good handful of them for like $28. It's crazy. Well, the same thing is going on with our food. And interestingly, on his basically, we're just being encouraged by the powers that be. It's like you talk about people that talk out of both sides of their mouths. On the one hand, it's like, whoa, we have a right up there at the executive level. Michelle Obama herself is going to promote healthy eating habits. Well, she doesn't appear to be the poster girl for good eating habits, just between ourselves. But she's not alone. She's not the only one doing it. Yes, we must do this. We must make this a movement. We must combat childhood obesity. We must combat adult obesity. It's like my dear old ex-Navy man dad used to say, if you don't want to be overweight, don't eat so much. But we're getting plenty of help. So get ready for David Robinson Simon right after this. A couple of charming and very interesting messages. And then the launch. This is Coast to Coast AM. David Robinson Simon, we summon you to the bridge of the mothership. Welcome, sir.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Listen, thanks for being on. This is insane. You know, Dr. Richard Miller was on last night saying, you know, children make better eating decisions than adults. I think he was right. And now your book, Meatonomics, it explores the unseen economic forces driving our animal food system and the weird ways these forces affect consumers, eating, spending, health, prosperity, and longevity. So I'm going to give you the floor because I already, between me and the commercials, we've already chatted away a quarter of our hour. So just let her rip. It's just you and me and a few million of our closest friends. Just let us have it.
Okay. Well, I make the point in the book that in the United States, producers of meat and dairy are aggressively and routinely controlling the decisions that consumers make about how much meat and dairy to eat. And we don't even know this is happening. This is happening in manipulative and subliminal ways. But for one thing, these producers keep retail prices at a very low level, a level that is artificially low, with the result that, for example, whenever McDonald's sells a Big Mac for $5, there are all these hidden costs that add up to another $8 that consumers don't pay. Those costs get imposed on society, and a Big Mac really costs $13. Because those prices are kept so low, we end up consuming something like twice as much meat and dairy as we would otherwise, and that's one of the reasons why in this country we have one of the highest rates of diseases of indulgence on a per capita basis. These are diseases like cancer, heart disease, diabetes, overweight, obesity.
Okay. All right. Now work it out for us a little bit. Tell us about these costs again. And you're talking about these things wind up costing, these little burgers wind up costing $13 because of the external forces of negative health that result in spending to correct these
right.
conditions?
Economists use this word externality. It's just a fancy word that means, for example, if I take my garbage out and put it on the curb in the morning and I pay the garbage collector to come pick it up, I internalize my garbage collection costs. On the other hand, if I take my garbage over to the park and dump it there at midnight, I externalize my garbage collection costs, meaning I impose those costs on society. And I show in the book that meat and dairy producers are externalizing the vast majority of their costs. So for every $1 of product they sell at retail, they externalize about $1.70 in costs. And that's mostly related to things like healthcare, but also related to things like environmental damage, subsidies, cruelty costs, and costs related to degradation of our oceans.
Okay. All right. Now, it's going to take a minute for me and us to get our minds around this, like these externalized costs. I mean, on your notes here, $414 billion yearly. Yearly retail sales around $250 billion. So for every $1 of product they sell, meat and dairy producers impose almost $2 in hidden costs on the rest of us. Now, just explain, how is this done to where, you know, somebody's struggling to understand this can understand?
Okay. It's not unusual for any industry to externalize some portion of its production costs. And we see this routinely in things like electricity generation. In order to make electricity, it's necessary to burn coal or oil. And the natural result of burning those products is some air pollution, some water pollution, and we can quantify the extent of that pollution. In the case of animal foods, these producers have surrounded themselves with an unusually robust and sophisticated network of legal protections that allows them to externalize on a proportionate basis much more of their costs than any other industry in this country. These animal food producers in the last 30 years have passed over 100 laws that surround them with this framework that allows them to push these costs out onto society. Most of these are in the form of healthcare costs. And one thing that might come as a shock to some listeners is that meat and dairy consumption, particularly at the very high levels at which we engage in this country, can be damaging to our health. In this country, we have the highest per capita rate of meat consumption in the world. We consume about 200 pounds of meat per person. And the clinical literature shows us increasingly over the last several decades that consuming meat and dairy at those very high levels is causing us to suffer not only from cancer, heart disease, and diabetes, but from other diseases like Parkinson's, arthritis, gout, and acid reflux, and others. So the healthcare costs associated with animal food producers encouraging, often with the help of the U.S. government, consumers to consume something like double the animal foods that we would otherwise are enormous. They're about $314 billion a year, or, you know, close to half of what we spend on Medicare every year in this country.
So we're actually being encouraged to, are we actually being brainwashed into eating twice the amount of meat that we really should eat, or should we not eat it at all? I mean, there's certainly an argument for that as well.
Well, some people would say brainwash is too strong a term, but I don't know if it is or not. So let me give you a few examples, and people can decide for themselves. We have these programs in this country called checkoff programs, and they're responsible for the messages that we see that say things like beef, it's what's for dinner; milk, it does the body good; pork, the other white meat. These checkoff programs are created by Congress. They're backed by the USDA. They're overseen by the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, so they are essentially creatures of the federal government. And in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2005 that when these programs speak one of their messages, like beef, it's what's for dinner, that they are actually speaking the message of the U.S. federal government. So what we have is our federal government telling us, eat more beef, eat more pork, drink more milk. And we get these messages. There's no one listening who has not heard or seen one of these messages on the internet, on a billboard, in a magazine, on TV. They're ubiquitous and they're everywhere. And yes, I think essentially we are being brainwashed into consuming much more of these products than we would otherwise.
You know, when you say something in advertising like helps relieve, I can't remember what it's called. It's right in there with an affirmation. It's a positive reinforcement. It doesn't really prove anything. It doesn't really even say anything substantive. I mean, what is helps relieve?
Right.
I mean, what is that?
Right.
But it sounds good, and we go, okay.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, one of the challenging features of these ads like milk, it does the body good, is that increasingly the clinical literature that's emerging from peer-reviewed studies that are not industry-funded tends to question that assertion. It's not completely clear today that milk does do a body good, or that people need to consume the milk of cows. Certainly, infant children need to consume their mother's milk. It's filled with antibodies and vitamins and other nutrients. But increasingly, the literature shows us that some of these things that the federal government is pushing on us are not proven to be as good for us as they're telling us.
David, let me ask you this. If you say, okay, if one were to submit that, okay, meat prices, let's say meat prices are kept artificially low, this in a subliminal or even an overt manner combined with the advertising makes people want to buy more meat. Say, we can buy a great big old piece of meat and we'll just enjoy it tonight. Say, it's still really cheap. Now, I don't call $28 a pound for, you know, ribeye to be, I don't consider that inexpensive. However, you know, it costs you $80 to usually to go out two people go out and have a dinner, you're going to spend $80 if there's this particular, there's a glass of wine involved.
Right.
So I'm not quite getting this. How do the low prices and the externalized costs, how does that come back to the meat producer, or does it? Where does the money go?
Well, the best way to look at an example of this is to look at what's happened with chicken prices and chicken consumption over the last 75 years or so. In roughly 1935, the average American ate something like 8 pounds of chicken per year, and chicken cost something like $5 a pound on an inflation-adjusted basis. So if you take today's prices and dial them back to 1935, and adjust for inflation, it's $5 a pound. Over the last 75 years, chicken prices have come down roughly 80%, and so today they're about $1.30 a pound, down from $5 a pound, and our consumption has gone from something like 8 pounds a person all the way up to something like 56 pounds per person, and that change in prices coupled with that increase in consumption is simply an example of consumer activity following the law of demand. And the law of demand says when prices go down, demand goes up and people buy more. That helps producers because it helps them sell more product, and they enjoy economies of scale, like raising 20,000 chickens in one shed, which they can do much more cheaply than back in 1935 when they were raising chickens in pasture conditions and conditions that sort of predated the factory farms that we have today.
All right. So just because you're not growing vegetables, if you're raising animals for sale, that's still agriculture, right?
That's right.
All right. Would you explain, do you feel like explaining agricultural subsidies, why a lot of farmers and raisers, ranchers and so forth, don't really like them? And are these things imposed on them? I mean, do they have to take them?
No, they don't have to take them, but it is interesting that most small farmers in this country don't like them, and that is because they don't get them. They typically are not on the receiving end of them. The research shows that something like 90% of the money is distributed to 20% of the farmers, and in many cases, the other 80% who get nothing or very little, some of them actually get nothing. They get absolutely nothing. And the effect of subsidies, because of the way they're crafted and the way that the money flows, is to benefit factory farms or large farming operations at the expense of smaller farming operations. And it's tending to put the smaller farms out of business in rural areas around the country. That is why, for example, in a poll done in Iowa several years ago, something like two-thirds of Iowans said they would favor eliminating all farm subsidies.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on into the this rush to organic and local foods. Well, I'll tell you what, before we get to that, there must be environmental costs as well.
There are. And that's one of the most troubling areas where we see a lot of externalization. There's a lot of published literature in the last few years where economists have attempted to add up the cost of factory farming, and the literature has looked at things like manure ponds where animal waste is stored. These ponds routinely leak at low levels into our groundwater and our rivers, lakes, and streams, and sometimes there are catastrophic leaks. There are issues of air pollution. There are issues of climate change being associated with animal production because, among other things, cows produce a lot of methane, and methane is something like 20 times more effective than carbon dioxide at creating greenhouse gas conditions. So the if you add up all the costs associated with the environmental costs, it comes to something like $37 billion a year associated with raising animals for food in this country. And just focusing on that dollar number may not be very meaningful because it's a big number. We don't really know how it's being allocated or where it's going, but we see real concrete evidence around us. For example, one third of American rivers and streams are polluted with animal waste. In studies where samples are taken to look for antibiotics, something like one in five streams is found to contain animal antibiotics. These are serious problems. This stuff is going into our water supply, or if we're swimming or boating, we're encountering it.
Okay. All right. All right. I'll tell you what. I hear the music in the background. You probably hear it too. So let's just pause for a moment. But when we come back, let's touch on a couple of other things. That would be animal cruelty. And if going local or organic really helps us. I understand there's a move in California. California, beautiful state, nice people. There's some sort of a movement there to label things natural, and they're somewhat unnatural. We'll be back. David Simon is our guest tonight for the first hour, and Simon says virtually all animals consumed in this country are produced in factory environments. Fish and farm animals have no legal rights, so it's perfectly legal to treat these animals in any way that's cost-effective, which often means chopping off body parts like beaks, genitals, and tails without anesthetic, hyper-confining animals in spaces too small to move, and denying various basic needs. Economists ran a live auction in which people used real money to bid on measures that would improve farm animals' lives. He extrapolated from this data to estimate what Americans would pay to end the five most egregious factory farming practices: battery cages for laying hens, gestation crates for pigs, zero grazing for dairy cows, genetic manipulation and hyperconfinement of broiler chickens, and inhumane slaughter of farmed fish. Using the real auction data, he estimates that Americans would pay about $21 billion to end these practices. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it's all about the Benjamins. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. David Simon, thanks for being with us at this late hour of the night. You know, I read a little story many years ago about monkeys. And it was about their teeth. Ah, yes, you know, they determined this was a monkey. It had the highly polished teeth of the fruit eaters. Okay. And then I looked at my own teeth and I thought, you know, there are a couple little canine teeth here. Those don't look like they're for fruit at all. Those look like they're for eating meat. So I began to look at other people's teeth. I'm serious. And you know, I found that some of them look like, God, what if that person bit you? That'd be pretty rough. You know, they're beautiful teeth. Ooh, those look like weapons. And others are kind of squared off and they look like really they're more for, you know, grain or vegetables or something. So I'm wondering, you know, it's easy to get into a twist. For example, Randy's raising heck out there. He's going, but these problems are more associated with GMO meats than organic meat. But I would submit to you that meat is not for everybody. That it agrees with some people. I mean, some people live into their 90s. They have bacon with every meal. If you've seen the bacon bowl now, you can make a bowl to put your taco salad in that's completely made out of bacon. Some people, bacon becomes the focal point of every meal. I'm like, bacon with every meal. There you go. That'll help somebody get right to, straight into type 2 diabetes, but not everybody. So would you agree that some people, meat's good for them, and other people, they shouldn't eat it?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would probably modify that slightly by saying, in moderation, almost anything can be good for us, or at least it can't be as harmful for us as it can be in excess. The problem is, in this country, we simply do meat to excess. We haven't learned moderation. You know, we're, as I mentioned earlier, we lead the world in per capita meat consumption. And in every age and sex demographic, we eat much more than even the USDA recommends that we should.
Yeah.
No, but you started off with an interesting anecdote about the monkey. And, you know, people have actually looked at humans' body morphology, our physical features, and attempted to determine what those features say about whether we need to eat meat or not. And I would say that there's controversy among scientists on this point. In the book, I actually cite a study by one doctor who looked at 10 features of a variety of different kinds of animals, including humans, including vegan animals and obligate carnivore animals. And by comparing these features that include things like teeth, intestine size, shape of the head, and a variety of other features, this physician, Michael Mills, comes to the conclusion that humans' bodies are not designed to eat meat. So there, you know, but other people have come to different conclusions. Personally, I don't eat it. I don't think that my body needs it, but I do know that there are people who tell me that they think that their bodies do.
I gotcha. Well, you know, prize fighters, they traditionally is always have a nice big steak and get all fired up on meat before you go. I don't know if that's just I don't know if that's the result of lore. Yes, you must eat some red bloody meat and you'll fight your best. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there.
Right.
You know, we wind up with all these ridiculous, I hate to say ridiculous traditions, but some of them are.
And, well, some of them are. You know, 50 years ago, cigarette companies were advertising 9 out of 10 doctors smoke Camels or Chesterfields. And you know,
it's one of the most healthful things you can do for your body. Right.
That's right. That's right.
All right. Well, let's, I'll tell you what, so animal cruelty would cost us $21 billion to end those practices. So that's not going to happen anytime soon.
No, but you know, interestingly, it could. If change were implemented across the board so that it affected all producers at once, it wouldn't affect their competitive position with respect to one another, and it could simply be implemented on a national basis. It's just that there's so much resistance from the producer community to doing anything that will cost them any additional money. You know, for example, it would only cost 25 cents per animal to anesthetize that animal before castrating him. But it doesn't sound like much, but 25 cents if you've got 100,000 animals works out to $25,000 a year. And the result is that nobody wants to pay that. And so animals are routinely castrated, which is to say their testicles are crushed or chopped off without anesthesia in this country.
Yeah. Well, so you got a lot of stuff out there that's borderline illegal. Or at least needs better regulation.
Yeah.
So what does the government do about it? I noticed that in your notes, you say the FDA, for example, has been trying unsuccessfully for more than 30 years to withdraw animal drugs that it says are unsafe for humans because they increase our risk of disease and antibiotic resistance. And we're now developing, superbugs are coming to the fore now that are definitely resisting any attempt to kill them with antibiotics. I mean, do you trace this back to the meat supply? We're eating a lot of meat, lots of antibiotics in it, we're all full of it, and therefore the various viruses and so forth just go around it.
That's right. You know, unfortunately, we're in a situation in this country where our regulatory agencies are, in many cases, heavily dominated by the industries that they regulate. An economist 100 years ago predicted this would happen. He called it regulatory capture, and he said that industries will actually seek regulation because they want the protection that it brings them, and that's what we see. So then the case of the FDA, that's right. It's taken the FDA more than 30 years to withdraw drugs that it determined in the 70s were dangerous. And even now, recently, it issued a recommendation that producers voluntarily stop using these drugs or seek a veterinary prescription when they're used. But it has still not done anything on a mandatory basis. And there are many, many examples of both the FDA and the USDA taking action that doesn't help consumers at all. These actions simply help the producers who have largely captured these agencies.
There's this fellow named Alan. He's a bit what I would call peckish. He says, come on, John, people have been eating meat for thousands of years. Is that a government conspiracy, too? It's like, no, Alan, you're just being peckish again. What the man's trying to say is if you stuff your face with meat continuously, you're liable to hurt yourself. I mean, isn't that the long and the short of it?
That's the long and the short of it.
Meat at every meal. Sausage and bacon for breakfast. Ham sandwich for lunch. Oh, let's have some jerky treats. No, don't give them to the dog. I'll eat them myself. And amplify something, David. And you did you say earlier that that like cancer is a disease of indulgence?
Well, Certainly, cancer can result from a variety of different factors, but one of them that the clinical literature shows is diet. Yes, and so if we overindulge in things that are known carcinogens, like red meat, we certainly can increase our risk of developing cancer. Colon cancer and prostate cancer are particularly linked to red meat. Breast cancer is linked to dairy. These aren't the only factors that can drive these cancers, genetic factors and other environmental factors as well. But certainly we can reduce our risk of developing these cancers by changing what we eat. And increasingly, when cancer is diagnosed in patients, some doctors are recommending vegan diets or even raw vegan diets to combat that cancer.
Now, I'm a little bit of a smart aleck here, so you'll please indulge me if I come off that way. But it's like, now, what led you to this work? I mean, was someone attacked by a steak that was near and dear to you and decided, I'm going to go after meat? I mean, what happened? How'd you get into this line of work here?
Well, I'm a lawyer, and about 6 years ago, I sent an email to a bunch of friends, many of whom were lawyers, and the email had a link in it to a video showing factory farming conditions. And I asked people, look at this video and tell me what you think about it. Because at the time, I didn't really know what to think about it myself, and I was curious what my friends would think. And one of the responses that I got back was from a friend who was the dean of a major law school and a law school professor. And he said, in his view, these conditions were disturbing and deplorable, but they were illegal. And because they were illegal, that meant that they were the exception to the rule, and they didn't rise to the level of a systemic problem that we need to concern ourselves with. And at the time, I simply didn't know how to respond to him. I didn't know whether that was true or not, because I didn't know what the law was concerning farm animals. But I do have access to legal resources, and as I started to do some research into this issue, I found out that he's simply wrong. It's not illegal to treat farm animals in these disturbing and deplorable ways that a lot of the emerging videos from factory farms show us. The reason is animal food producers in this country have gone to bat at Congress and at the state level to pass scores and scores of laws that allow them to do virtually anything to an animal being raised for food in this country.
Well, you know, it seems like the government entities, the one that comes to mind is the former mayor of New York, and that would be Michael Bloomberg. He's going after, cigarettes are like $14 and a half per pack up there. Gee, those must be really delicious. They're so expensive. I got to have some, right?
Right.
And he went after soda pop. No big, gigantic soda pops. Now, you can buy two small ones, 2 8-ounces, and you're good, but you can't get a 16-ounce one. So he's gone, and de Blasio's in, and blah, blah. But the thing is, I don't hear anybody going after. I don't hear anybody going after meat. It's like, you're obese, you're disgusting, you're all in bad health. As a matter of fact, health care in this country is so bad, and the health of the American people is so bad, we've just got to have socialized medicine. So that's the new scam. So
that's right.
How do we solve this problem? Individual change and institutional change, I suppose.
Well, I think the example you gave of the cigarettes, even though that's shocking to pay $14 or $15 for a pack of cigarettes, in my view, that's really the right approach. You know, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that each package of cigarettes sold in this country carries externalized costs with it of more than $10 per pack. So that if an average pack of cigarettes would cost $5, when you look at what it costs society, the total is about $15. And that means that if we're actually imposing a tax of $10 per pack on cigarettes, we're coming close, at least in New York City, where these taxes are the highest in the country, we're coming close to recovering that entire externalized cost. And that's a good thing, because by making the price of cigarettes reflect the true cost to society, it adjusts the supply and demand curves in a way that reduces consumption. So I would suggest that in a similar vein, the way to approach meat consumption would be to tax it as well. One of the things that I propose in the book is a 50% tax on meat at the point of sale. I know that will strike people as high, but in comparison, we tax tobacco products in this country at an average of about 70%. So that puts that number in some perspective. What that 50% meat tax would do would be to reduce our consumption down to a level more closely approximating what it should be if prices actually reflected their true economic cost of production.
Now, the part that I'm not getting is who gets the money?
The money would go, the tax I propose would be a federal excise tax. So the federal government would collect the money. And I also propose an offsetting tax credit so that people get back some of those funds in a way that basically causes them simply to shift their demand. So you'd pay more for each meat product you buy, but you'd get a tax credit at the end of the year, and then you'd use those dollars to buy substitute foods like fruits and vegetables.
So, you would agree that there is something to this GMO thing. Have you gotten much into that? Clearly, the evidence would suggest that going with non-GMO fed beef and so forth and the so-called organic variety is much more healthy for you.
Certainly it's better to, in everything we eat, whether it's an animal-based product or a plant-based product, it's better to go for the non-GMO version. The problem is the U.S. FDA refuses to issue regulations requiring that foods be labeled so that consumers can tell whether they are GMO or non-GMO. So today, if a producer voluntarily chooses to tell you which food is non-GMO, that's certainly helpful. But if it's a GMO product, they're not required to inform us. There are even GMO animal foods coming out. There's a genetically modified salmon that's going to be hitting the market soon that will not be labeled as a GMO product. And so people who buy salmon at their grocery store won't know whether they're buying a natural salmon or a salmon that has been implanted with the genes of two other fish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're probably going to get a good shot of genetically mutated salmon before too long, too.
That's right.
That's another story for another time.
Right.
All right, so... It was interesting. I keep going back to Dr. Miller last night. He said it takes 5% of the population to really effect a profound change, which goes along with Wells's theory of 5%, which is 85% of the people out there doing something need to be doing something else. 5% on top of that could do it, but will literally be prevented from doing it by some external reason. Another 5%. Will just decide not to, even though they have the talent, they have the capability, they just won't do it, leaving 5%. So, now, I don't want you to by default, be put in the category of, you're a revenuer, you're another tax guy. So, you know, because nobody likes taxes.
Right.
But the proposal wouldn't really cost anything because it would be offset with an actual tax credit. Is that your idea?
Well, that's right. The tax idea that I propose in the book wouldn't end up affecting consumers on an out-of-pocket basis because although we would pay more for each transaction in which we buy animal foods, we would get back a tax credit at the end of the year that would approximately offset the additional amount that we spend. And the only result is that in the course of that year, we would shift our consumption habits to healthier foods.
And is this true? Almost 200,000 fewer human deaths from cancer, diabetes, and heart disease each year, 26 billion fewer land and marine animals killed each year, a 3.4 trillion pound drop in the emission of CO, carbon dioxide equivalent, CO2, an area twice the size of Texas would no longer be needed for agriculture, could be to return to forest, grassland, and other native habitat, $26 billion in annual savings to Medicare and Medicaid, and yearly surplus of cash in the amount of $32 billion in the U.S. Treasury. Is that all possible?
Those are all the projections that the economic literature suggests we could realize from a meat tax in this country. That's right.
And how do we get your book?
My book is available anywhere books are sold, Meatonomics. It's online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. The website is meatonomics.com, meatonomics.com.
Now, as far as we've got about a minute here, but what can the individual do to just decide All right. I'm going to roll with this for a while and see if I feel better. There are a lot of people that are not that good of not good health at all. And a lot of it can be traced to diet.
You know,
how do you motivate people to just change, make the change?
That's right. I've gotten a lot of feedback on the book. It's been reviewed in a variety of publications, but one of the things that rewarded me the most was an individual who wrote to me and said, "Your book has changed my life. I'm 67. I had open heart surgery, but I'm going to change my diet based on what you say in your book." And he's going to change to a plant-based diet, and that's what a lot of individuals can do. Let me just give you three statistics. On average,
I don't think we have time, my brother.
Okay.
The clock is ticking off. But listen, you must come back. I'll get a hold of you. I have your book. I have your book right here, as a matter of fact, Meatonomics. David Simon, thanks so much for coming on the program tonight. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
And he had a clear phone line, too. Meatonomics.com. We'll be back.